It is rather ironic that a country that built an important part of its economic success, military strength, and certainly sort of soft power appeal on research universities that drew people from all over the world now seems to be doing everything it can to drive the successors to those that it attracted, you know, back out of the country, you know, to Canada, to Europe, to Asia. And if that continues for a few years, you know, the world may look very differently. And I think European leaders in universities and in government, as well as in business, should try to take advantage of it, you know, sad as it is that these are the circumstances.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged. Leaders Unplugged is a real talk with the impactful, candid, honest, actionable, and fresh from behind the scenes. Presented by IMD and hosted by IMD's president, David Back, and myself, Felix Zeltner, founder of Remote Daily. Now, today, for our fourth episode, we turn the tables again, like in the very beginning of this podcast, and I get the chance to host David and put him on the guest seat. And together, we went from the battle over American academia to his recent trip to the Middle East, all the way to the meaning of good leadership in these times. So, here's a bit of context to kick us off. The Trump administration has threatened, and in most cases withheld, billions of dollars in federal grants and contracts from elite colleges in the United States, largely based on allegations of anti-Semitism on campuses. Private institutions like Harvard, Columbia, and Johns Hopkins, and public ones such as the University of Minnesota or UCLA, are already affected. The administration also announced grant terminations and the freeze on new grants for far more institutions, including universities in North Carolina, Texas, and Florida. And a few days prior to our recording, more than 150 presidents of US colleges and universities signed a statement together denouncing the Trump administration's, quote, unprecedented government overreach and political interference, unquote. Among the subscribers are the presidents of Yale and Berkeley. David went to both these schools. In Berkeley, he got his PhD, and in Yale, he got his BA, and he returned to work there, actually, for 8 years before joining IMD. So, to kick us off today, I challenge David by saying there is a lot of people who think that taking taxpayer money away from these very wealthy universities, like the ones you attended, these multi-billion dollar machines, is maybe not a bad thing. It's maybe a good thing, because why would they need public funding? We can use that elsewhere. And I ask David what his response is to people who make this argument.
Well, I completely understand why they would make that argument, but they're mistaken. Now, it's not the public's job to understand how U.S. higher education funding works. I think one of the mistakes that leaders in elite universities in particular have made is to not explain more broadly to the public all the great work that they do, that even though they're a highly selective institution, you know, you take a place like, you know, Harvard or Yale or Stanford, you know, they admit 3-3.5% of the undergraduates who apply there. They're incredibly selective institutions. And yet the research that happens there, the contribution to policy debates, the cultural heritage that gets preserved, you know, all of those things benefit the public. They benefit America. They benefit the world. And, you know, these institutions, I think they all recognize they could have done a better job explaining that more emphatically. One of the things that impresses me about what Harvard is doing right now is they're not just explaining why they're resisting the Trump administration, they're also highlighting how the work that happens at a place like Harvard, work that happens with federal funding, actually benefits the public at large. So basically, to answer your question, you know, for several decades, there's been a close partnership between the U.S. government and these elite research universities, where the U.S. government has underwritten or collaborated with on fundamental research in particular, research that companies wouldn't fund, and that is very expensive, and it would be very difficult for these universities to fund in their own right. Certainly, they couldn't fund it out of tuition, and not every donor is going to fund fundamental research. And so there's been this really important partnership. These universities have built laboratories, have hired faculty, have built whole programs around this research funding. And look, I think if the U.S. wants to have a conversation about the model of research funding at universities, let's have that conversation. Maybe there are better ways of doing this. I would argue that leveraging top research universities is a more effective way of doing that research than, say, government-owned laboratories, which is the model that you see in other parts of the world. But it's okay to have that conversation. But of course, that's not what's happening. The funds are being canceled one day to the next over something, you know, anti-Semitism, that is a really, really important concern, but not related to, you know, foundational research on the next generation of antibiotics or research on the origins of the universe, right? These things are not linked. It's being used to pressure these universities. And in the process, this really important work stops. And, you know, I've spoken to colleagues who have described situations where people are literally walking away from petri dishes. There are ongoing experiments that can't come to a conclusion because, you know, funding has disappeared and labs have been shut down.
Wow. And you're also saying that, yes, from a communication standpoint, there could have been a different approach over the last couple of years and maybe being more transparent about where are we using what money. And I think in this letter that I spoke about in the beginning, that these more than 150 university leaders now have signed, it also says, hey, we're willing and able to talk. Let's talk about this, where we use the government money. But the last sentence of this letter says, on behalf of our current and future students and all who work at benefit from our institutions, we call for constructive engagement that improves our institutions and serves our republic. And when I read that, I thought, wow, this is the last phrase of this letter that all these presidents signed. This is the call to action. Do you think, David, that this call for a constructive conversation, quote unquote, is going to work? What do you think is going to happen now?
So I think the constructive conversation is really, really important. And of course, you referred before to their large budgets. You called them multi-billion dollar enterprises, and that's right. And of course, the numbers that then often get added to this is the amount of endowment, right? So Harvard has over $50 billion in endowment. And so people look at this and say, man, I mean, that's more than the GDP of dozens of countries. You know, clearly they don't need that money. This is a system that is difficult to understand if you're not close to it. And certainly, you know, among European friends, I've frequently found myself shedding a bit of light of this. What this is, you know, people making donations, often former students who are grateful for the opportunity that they got. And instead of making a donation that can be spent, right, a spendable gift, they're making a donation to endowment, which means the money gets invested. It generates a return. That return is, you know, often 7, 8, 9% if it's done well. And then the university takes a good chunk of the interest, right, 5, 6, 7% of that, and uses it to fund scholarships, to fund research, to fund activities. And what that means is it funds those things in perpetuity. So there isn't a pot of money sitting in a savings account that the university could just use at any time. The money is invested, and the interest actually constitute for many of these universities about a third of their budgets. It funds scholarships, it funds professorships, it funds programs, it funds research. And so, you know, sure, you know, you can find some ways to dip into this, but you're basically depriving the institution of its opportunities to do this really important work in the future. Again, this is another one of the contributors to why U.S. Elite institutions have been the envy of the world. How is this going to end? I have no idea. I think there are a number of universities, Harvard is one of them, that can withstand that pressure for some time. There are others, like the ones that you mentioned in the introduction, for whom this will mean in the not too distant future some severe cuts in activities, in scholarships, you know, maybe even in academic departments or sort of research programs that they can sustain. And I just hope that enough people recognize that what is happening here is an undermining of one of America's just extraordinary strengths, and that hurting these institutions or crippling these institutions is not in the country's best interest, and that even people who may not have studied there or who may not even aspire to study there recognize that. Now, that requires dialogue. I suspect much of that dialogue is going to be with the public. Mm-hmm. I assume some of that dialogue may be with members of Congress. I'm not sure how much of that dialogue is actually going to happen with the Trump administration, because there are people in the government who have been very overt about the fact that they're looking to destroy a number of these institutions to send a message. And of course, they want to do that because they view them as predominantly liberal, and so source of potential opposition to what the government is doing. And so if that's the attitude, it's going to be very, very difficult to have constructive conversations. Mm-hmm.
You gave us this image before of scientists literally walking away from Petri dishes right now because there is no money anymore landing in the bank accounts that would fund their lab. And of course, on your side of the Atlantic, now there is leaders from universities and schools looking at these scientists and saying, if you turn away from your Petri dishes, why don't you come over to us? And there have been calls by a couple of universities from several European countries already to say, how can we together offer American scientists or scientists working in America right now a new home? Is there maybe even a chance to create new grants from the European Union? And it also is somewhat similar to a conversation in the technology industry right now in Europe, where there have also been massive layoffs in the US, and there's the same conversation. Is there a chance we can lure this talent that we have been so envious of over across the Atlantic to us? So how realistic do you think this is?
I mean, I think it's happening, Felix. I mean, we don't know the numbers, but we have lots of anecdotal evidence that leading U.S. scientists are in conversations with top research universities in Europe. I've spoken to a number of university leaders who've confirmed this. You referenced government programs. The French government is working with universities to provide some funding to attract scientists. And you're quite right. I mean, it is to some extent a brain gain or a reverse brain drain, because for so many decades, leading scientists from all over the world, or aspiring scientists, including, of course, from Europe, have gone to the United States. You know, I'll add something that is, you know, perhaps even more startling. You know, U.S. research universities really become the global reference point, in part because during the 1930s, 20s, 30s, and 40s, they became a home for European refugees. You know, you see how the number of Nobel Prizes going to European scientists drops as a result of the disaster in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, you know, fascism and the Second World War, and how it rises in the U.S. afterwards, right? So this doesn't take anything away from what was achieved in the United States to point out that, you know, what helped take U.S. universities to the next level was the influx of scientists who fled Europe. Now, I want to be very careful and not suggest that what is happening in the United States now is comparable to the horrors of 1930s and 1940s Europe, but it is rather ironic that a country that built an important part of its economic success, military strength, and certainly sort of soft power appeal on research universities that drew people from all over the world now seems to be doing everything it can to drive the successors to those that it attracted, you know, back out of the country, you know, to Canada, to Europe, to Asia. And if that continues for a few years, you know, the world may look very differently. And I think European leaders in universities and in government, as well as in business, should try to take advantage of it. You know, sad as it is that these are the circumstances.
In several industries, there is always a conversation about money when it comes to, is it possible to attract talent from the US? And the end argument is often, well, we just cannot match the salaries that are being paid. Let's say this was the conversation in the technology industry for the last year or so, since there have been massive layoffs. There was always the counter argument, especially from leaders that I listened to in Germany, saying it's just not possible. There, maybe we can offer some other things, but we cannot match these salaries. How is that in the academia? Do you think there is the same problem?
Well, I mean, we're not nearly as well paid as our friends in the technology sector. One of my professors in graduate school pointed out to one of my friends in the PhD program. He said to her, "You've already demonstrated an irrational attitude to his money by deciding to pursue a PhD." we're well paid, but we're not in the same league as some of the tech entrepreneurs you were referring to. So I think on salaries, there are clearly some gaps. But what we as academics look for isn't necessarily the highest salary. It's an environment where we're surrounded by amazing colleagues, where we have institutions that support us. But of course, particularly for those in the life sciences, it does require laboratories, staff, right, equipment. And so if we want to attract some of those scientists, particularly in the life sciences and physical sciences, you do need investment in universities. But we should be doing that in Europe anyway to increase our investment in universities. And it might help us attract some top talent from across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. I want us to pivot at this moment, because I thought it was really interesting to talk about, regions and also IMD, because I'm learning as we host this podcast together about the vast network that IMD has across the globe. And of course, there's you and many others who have experience in the US, and you're doing a lot of programs on this side of the Atlantic, but you also have a hub in Singapore, and you're very, very active in so many other parts of the globe. And you just returned from the Gulf region, from the Middle East, a region that is changing, that is fascinating, aspiring to many. What were you actually doing there, David? Can you take us into what happened?
Yeah, sure. I was really fortunate to spend 5 days traveling in the Middle East. So I was in Saudi Arabia, I was in Kuwait, and I was in the Emirates. And in the Emirates, I split my time between Abu Dhabi and Dubai. And it was a great visit because of the vibrancy of the region. In each of these places, I met IMD alumni. We have strong alumni communities in all of those places. We had a terrific event hosted by the Swiss Embassy at the Swiss Embassy in Riyadh. We had a great gathering in Kuwait. We had a terrific event with alumni in Abu Dhabi. And of course, in addition to meeting alumni and updating them on what's happening at IMD and learning how they're doing and what they're doing, I also met with a number of CEOs of companies that we work with, whose leadership development we support. I met with government officials. I met with some members of the news media to share perspective and, just had conversations about what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in Europe, what's happening globally, and what are the opportunities for us to intensify our collaboration.
Now, the Middle East itself is super complex, of course, but the states that you visited in particular are part of the Gulf region, which always seems to impress with speed and optimism and a highly entrepreneurial mindset. Were there any specific moments that stuck with you, that surprised you, any learnings that you can share? Maybe companies or leaders that you met that should be shared on this podcast, because they're saying, if you're a leader right now, you should look at these people and their organizations and what they're doing.
We just talked about the need to increase funding for universities and to invest in research, in science, and in education. And those are priorities in that part of the world.